Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Pope Benedict XVI calls for dialogue and reconciliation in Honduras. We continue in our in-depth analysis of Pope Benedict's encyclical Caritas in Veritate. Srebrenica Memorial Day is commemorated throughout the European Union, passing on a lesson never to be forgotten. And film critic Peter Malone takes us into the world of the Depression-era bank robber John Dillinger. Pope Benedict XVI has called for dialogue and reconciliation in Honduras. His appeal came on Sunday in remarks following the Angelus with the faithful in St. Peter's Square. Chris Altieri has this report.
In remarks to the faithful following the Sunday Angelus in St. Peter's Square, the Holy Father said he is following the events of recent days in Honduras with deep concern. Honduras is currently the scene of a political stalemate after a coup last month that has brought international sanctions, raising the specter of further hardship and want for an already sorely tried populace.
Vorrei oggi invitarvi a pregare per quel caro paese.
Pope Benedict invited the faithful to pray for the maternal intercession of Our Lady of Suyapa in favor of the dear nation of Honduras, for the nation's leaders and all its people, that they might patiently walk the path of dialogue, mutual understanding, and reconciliation. The Holy Father went on to say this is possible if everyone in the country strives to look beyond particular interests, to seek the truth and tenaciously pursue the common good. Peaceful coexistence and genuine democratic life, he said, depend upon it.
E questa la condizione per assicurare una convivenza pacifica e un'autentica vita democratica.
The Holy Father assured the Honduran people of his prayers and gave them a special apostolic blessing. Ahead of the traditional prayer of Marian devotion, the Holy Father called on world leaders to work together to seek real answers to the serious problems facing all humanity. He said there are social inequalities and structural injustices in the world that are no longer tolerable.
Le problematiche in agenda erano talora drammaticamente urgenti.
In addition to immediate action, he said, they require a coordinated strategy to find lasting solutions. The Pope's appeal came in the wake of last week's G8 summit in L'Aquila, Italy, and days after the release of his encyclical letter, Caritas in Veritate, to which he referred, saying the Church does not have technical solutions to offer, but is able to offer all the teachings of the gospel of love and justice. I'm Chris Altieri.
Thanks there to Chris Altieri for that report. As Chris was mentioning whilst speaking about his encyclical, the Pope himself reiterated at the Angelus that although the Church may not have all the technical solutions to the problems afflicting the world today, it is an expert in humanity and offers to all mankind teachings of truth, justice and love. Now it's been almost a week since the publication of Caritas in Veritate, and if you've been following Vatican Radio's programmes dedicated to this third encyclical of Pope Benedict XVI, maybe you heard Dominican sister Helen Alford, Dean of the Faculty of Social Sciences at the Pontifical University of St. Thomas here in Rome, tell my colleague Veronica Scaresbrick her thoughts regarding the first part of the encyclical, dedicated by the Pope to Paul VI's encyclical, Populorum Progressio, Development of Peoples. In this second part of that interview, Veronica asks Sister Helen Alford what relevance does she think the encyclical may have in the world today.
I know this encyclical is addressed to people who believe in God, but the idea that God can find a place in the public arena is a little bit far-fetched. If you think that the movers and shakers in the economic and financial world, a lot of them don't believe in God. Am I wrong?
Well, I think in the part of the world that we're in, that's true. But there's more and more books now talking about European exceptionalism, as they call it, that saying that Europe is a bit different from the rest of the world in precisely in this very kind of strong process of secularization. Other rich parts of the world, obviously United States is the most obvious example, have a different relationship with religion, which isn't nearly so negative in that sense. So I think that's one factor. I think, though, you're right that many of the people involved in the whole development debate and in the international organizations are quite secularized. However, we shouldn't, I don't think, underestimate the value they put on documents like these encyclicals. I give you one example. A previous encyclical in this series, Commemorating Populorum Progressio, was by John Paul, Solitudo Rei Socialis, which came out in 1987. After that encyclical was published, they had a big seminar in the UN in New York on this encyclical. That was in 1988. Then a couple of years later, the first UN Development Programme report focusing on human development was produced. So we can't say there's a direct connection between the encyclical and the fact that the UN Development Programme changed its focus from looking at development as an economic question only to development as primarily human development. We don't know that that was directly caused by the encyclical, but they certainly were interested in what the Pope was saying, and all we can say is that 2 years after they had that seminar, they were producing reports on human development, which have become very, very important. Those reports have really changed the focus of international policymakers from thinking about development in terms of increasing gross domestic product, which was the way pretty much people thought about it before, to thinking about development as what is happening to human beings, which is exactly what the Church would like to see.
Pope Benedict in the encyclical points to the role of the state in encouraging a civilization of economy. Okay. Is this the civilization of economy he's talking about?
Well, certainly policymakers have an incredible influence over the way people think. So, and since most policymakers are in state institutions, policies usually produced by states or by international bodies, the way they think about development is going to have either a civilizing or a not civilizing effect. You know, they are some of the key people who influence the way we think about these things. They also have a big influence on the media. They have big resources for doing research. So if they're guiding their research in certain lines, then we get progress in a helpful direction or not, depending on what their policy is. And so they are crucial people who influence the direction of development and the direction of where funds go, what we actually do to try to improve a situation which, even though we are in a different situation from Paul VI in the 60s, still nevertheless is a dramatic situation with billions of people with very little to eat, displaced, huge inequalities in the world. I mean, we're not in a terribly different position today from the one that Paul VI was in that regard.
There's a widening gap.
In some respects, it's getting worse, yeah. Some countries, especially some of the African countries, are poorer now than they were in the 60s. So it's true that big countries like China and India have made big strides forward, but that masks, if you look at a world scale, it masks really serious problems developing in other areas, especially Africa. Yeah.
Does this encyclical connect anyway with Pope Benedict's first encyclical, God is Love? There's a social slant there, isn't
there? Yes, there is, in the second part, partly because the first encyclical was also inspired by Cor Unum, which is also behind this encyclical.
Cor Unum being the Vatican body that handles the charity and aid that the Pope offers to people in difficulty, right?
So Cor Unum wanted, I know this because it happened before John Paul died, they wanted an encyclical on charity. So they, and of course the Pope himself, when he was elected, he wanted his first encyclical to be on this issue. So the two things came together. So the second part, the part that's more on charity and action, was very influenced by Cor Unum. That's the first encyclical. So they also were involved in the writing of this one. So yes, there's a clear connection because, as we said, charity in terms of gratuitous giving, not necessarily in terms of giving people their rights and involving them in the economic and social process, which is also important, but charity in terms of gratuitous giving is also very important, and that comes across.
Of course, the Church has always had social doctrine at the heart of its teaching right down the centuries,
isn't it? Oh, yes. Well,
Bernard de Clairvaux, for example, in the Charter.
Exactly, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, we can go right back to even the Jewish times. You know, if you look at the Old Testament, the very strong judgments that would come through the prophets on the Jewish people if they didn't treat their workers properly, if they didn't pay them properly, if they didn't, you know, this is a very, very deeply rooted in Christian tradition and in the roots on which the Christian tradition is based. So now it's become a more explicit teaching, but it's always been there in the history of the church. Yeah.
You mentioned how you were struck by the fact that economists had helped to draw up the encyclical. Was that something new to have technical people move in?
No, I don't think so, because it's also pretty well known that, for instance, Quadragesimo Anno, done in 1931, was influenced by Gundlach, and von der Breuning was more the German economists who were influencing that, German thinkers. This time it's been more a group of Italian economists. But the point that I think is important here is that the church recognizes, and it's said in the encyclical itself, that the technical competence that is being gained in the social sciences, like economics, like sociology, is very, very important. It doesn't replace the social teaching, but the social teaching is in direct dialogue with these sciences in order to be able to say something sensible that relates to people's concrete lives. Hence why the encyclicals need to be renewed, because there's a part of them which is continuous, the teaching doesn't change. There's a part also that is trying to deal with the problems of that time, and of course they move on, problems don't stay the same. So it's a very good example, actually, in the way in which the encyclical is written, this combination of the church's pastors with technical experts. It's a very good example of how social teaching itself should work in all situations, you know, this combination of what the church has to offer with what the best of our thinking has to offer too.
May I ask you one last question? Is there anything else that struck you in a particular way in this encyclical, you personally? Either as Helen Alford or as a Dominican?
Well, I suppose one thing that did strike me was that I saw that the name of the focolare approach to making this connection between deep values of life and the economy, which is called the economy of communion, I noticed that that was included in the encyclical. And that made me think of how in Pope Paul's encyclical, in Populorum Progressio, he made direct reference to Father Lebray, who was a Dominican priest, who had been developing a lot this idea of development. And Paul VI was very close to him, and he actually quotes Lebray in the encyclical. And so now, 40 years on, instead of the Dominicans being quoted, it's Focolare that gets a direct quote. And I think that's also indicative of, you know, some of the changes that have been occurring in the church, and how now these big lay movements, how important that they are. They're producing ideas and producing results which are important enough to be included in an encyclical.
Well, maybe the next social encyclical will have Sister Helen Alford, the Dominican.
Well, that would be something. I don't know about that.
That was Dominican Sister Helen Alford, Dean of the Faculty of Social Sciences at the Pontifical University of St. Thomas, here in Rome, speaking to Veronica Scaresbrick. Meanwhile, Pope Benedict XVI begins his two-week annual holiday today in Le Combe in the northern region of Valle d'Aosta. During this time, the Pope has planned at least two public appearances during which he will pray with the faithful. And after his stay in the Aosta Valley, Benedict will travel to the papal summer residence of Castel Gandolfo, south of Rome, where he will remain until the end of September. Fourteen years have gone by, but thinking back, you may remember that terrible July of 1995, during which the so-called Srebrenica massacre took place. You may remember the news that slowly filtered through, telling the world of the more than 8,000 Muslim men and boys in the Bosnian town of Srebrenica who were summarily executed by Bosnian Serb forces. As they sought safety in an isolated enclave, that had been proclaimed a protected zone by a United Nations Security Council resolution. That massacre was perpetrated by Bosnian Serb forces commanded by General Ratko Mladic under the direction of the then president of the Republika Srpska, Radovan Karadzic. You may also remember that at that time, nearly 25,000 women, children and elderly people were killed or forcibly deported, making this event the biggest war crime to take place in Europe since the end of the Second World War. 14 years have gone by, but for the first time on 11th of July 2009, the commemorative ceremony of the Srebrenica genocide was officially celebrated, not only in Bosnia, but in all European Union countries. This is thanks to a resolution by the European Parliament that has finally declared this date to be the day of commemoration of the Srebrenica genocide. That is important news, I thought, because as I learnt years ago while doing programmes with World War II veterans, remembering is so important. History lessons are not just chapters in books. They are to be passed from generation to generation so that mistakes and terrible tragedies be avoided in the future. And turning back to the Bosnian genocide, only 14 years have gone by, but already, for some, the memory is dim.
Especially young Bosnians, Serbs in particular.
Kemal Pervanic is a Bosnian Muslim survivor of the concentration camps of the Bosnian Serb War.
There's a whole new generation of young Serb teenagers who were either born during the war or after the war and who don't remember what kind of life we lived before the war, togetherness that existed between all different nationalities and religions. And these young people don't remember what happened during the war, unfortunately. They know what they are told by their parents. And the prevailing belief in the Serb community, at least the Serb community where I come from the northwest of Bosnia, is that they themselves were the real victims of this war. And on my journeys back to Bosnia, I can see these young Serbs sporting images of Karadzic on their T-shirts because he's their national hero. And for me, most of these teenagers are what I called a lost generation. And it's a real, real shame because these people are the future of the country.
So, as Jasna Krivozic-Pripic, ambassador of Bosnia and Herzegovina to the Holy See, told me, a commemoration such as this is important for more reasons than one. Not only does it contain a lesson for the world over, but for those whose lives were disrupted and marred by the tragedy, it is a way to shape a collective memory so that they can move forward and in some way reconstruct normality. Paying respect to the victims of the Srebrenica tragedy, Ambassador Krivozic Pripic said, also means honouring European values.
For the relatives of those who are identified, they are satisfied that their remains can finally be buried and find peace and laid to rest. Majority of them, I have to point out that we are civilians, a lot of them innocent children. They were in so-called safe zone, protected by international community and General Mladic promised publicly. But human integrity is very often questionable and promises are made not always to be kept. And I think we all have to address this painful issue to remember, not to forget, to avoid that such a tragedy happens again.
The ambassador told me that if you go to Srebrenica today, you can visit the Srebrenica Memorial Room, a specially designed museum-style space to remember and reflect on the terrible massacre.
This idea was proposed by Lord Ashdown, former High Representative in Bosnia-Herzegovina, who visited the Imperial War Museum, London's Holocaust exhibition, and felt that something similar was needed at Srebrenica Potočari Cemetery to narrate the events of July 1995, when over 8,000 Bosnian Muslim men and boys were murdered following the taking over of Bosnian Serb forces. The memorial itself was designed by local architects and consists of two black towers. This might be interesting for your listeners. One presenting a continuous running film, the other containing 20 showcases, telling the stories of 20 those who died. Miss Susan Bargett, director of Holocaust exhibition at London's Imperial War Museum, was curator and advisor to the local team.
As I mentioned at the beginning, numerous commemorative events were in fact organized throughout the European Union.
In Bosnia-Herzegovina, the one which I would like to mention is the exhibition of well-known painters, Tikveša and Zec, dedicated to Srebrenica, but at the same time to pay tribute to the European parliamentarian Italian Alexander Lentner, who killed himself in 1995 since he could not bear to watch the passivity and lack of involvement of the international community. This day is also remembered all over the globe. I'm just giving examples. In Berlin, in front of Bundestag and Brandenburg Gate, four evenings of performance. Actors will call the names of the UN and NATO officials, decision makers who called back the warplanes flying over Adriatic, being ready to prevent the massacre.
The commemorations, Ambassador Krivosic Pripic told me, are important as they contain an important history lesson not to be forgotten by future generations.
Right now in Bosnia-Herzegovina is on its path to the European Atlantic integration, and we are making efforts to strengthen interreligious dialogue, supporting work of the Interreligious Council, Commission for Justice, Truth and Reconciliation, introducing Culture for Peace in its educational programs. Together with the international community, state authorities are trying to revive economy, locating projects in Srebrenica, which will be attractive for investment and create conditions for sustainable return and prosperous life. A clearer common vision, unity, respect of human rights and religious freedoms can bring us closer to the European Union.
Ambassador, the Balkans is a difficult area. As we were speaking on the phone the other day, you mentioned the need to overcome in some way so that it doesn't become a vicious circle and the violence does not reignite. Do you think that we are on the right road to doing that?
The pace, for me personally, is not perhaps good enough. But I think if the people, first of all, locally and then internationally, we'll understand, we'll just have a big picture and we'll understand that we need, like I already mentioned, clear common vision and unity, respecting at the same time human rights and religious freedoms. That really could speed up the process of reconciliation and at the same time of economic growth for the country and the region as a whole. And that's the only way out. It's if we talk about past, we have to remember, we have to pay respect, but we have to think about future and the new generations, and we need critical mass of people who are for the fresh start. But before that, we have to address painful subjects. Srebrenica is just one of them.
It's very, very painful. I went onto your webpage just to brush up the facts and, you know, just read the figures again. And I found it very, very difficult to read and to look at. And all this knowing that in other parts of the world, something similar is happening today.
Yes, it's devastating. And because of that, I pointed out those three, perhaps, commemoration events or data just to make people think how important it is, because human nature is difficult to be changed. So how important it is really to predict and to prevent and to think and address those subjects of human integrity and real values, human values, and because it could happen. It's happening. It happened in Rwanda. It's happening these days in other countries. But it's a problem of perhaps clear rules, and also of a commitment and involvement of people. And I just, because of that, pointed out this young Italian who killed himself. It's rare example. Most of them can live with a conscience, obviously.
Thank you very, very much, Ambassador. You seem to have faith in human nature.
You have to. That's the only way, I think, to be positive somehow and to create positive energy.
And now it's over to my friend, film critic Peter Malone, who heads the film office at CIGNAS, the World Catholic Association for Communication. Today he takes us into the world of a famous Depression-era bank robber.
It's about the famous John Dillinger, who's right. been in so many films and television series over the years, and Melvin Purvis, the G-Man, I think, on whom Elliot Ness was based. So it's taking us back to the 1930s.
Did you like the film?
I did. I wouldn't say that I was excited by it, and I'm not sure that I was always drawn into it, but I did admire it and the way that it was made and the performances.
Johnny Depp.
Johnny Depp is an interesting character to play John Dillinger. I was wondering, because sometimes in the past, like with The Godfather, some critics say, oh, well, it's glamorising the mafia, or it's glamorising the gangsters, or Bonnie and Clyde is making them folk heroes, that kind of thing. Well, I suppose it actually did happen in the day that Dillinger was somehow or other considered a bit of a folk hero. I'd imagine if a contemporary Dillinger in the United States started robbing all the banks, that the public wouldn't be entirely out of sympathy with him,
well,
given that these days. So it was the Depression. But in choosing Johnny Depp, I think they wanted to show the fact that he had charm, which he does, but the screenplay also shows him as absolutely ruthless.
What is it exactly you do for a living?
John Dillinger, rob banks.
That's a serious thing to say to a girl you just met.
I like baseball, movies, good clothes, fast cars, and you. What else do you need to know?
So I thought, well, it is a good choice, and Johnny Depp can, you know, do any kind of role these days. He's very skillful just being there. So he creates a character with Dillinger, even though it doesn't look as if he's making a great effort. But when the thing is over, you do have quite a strong impression of Dillinger.
I see here, just reading about the film and watching the trailer, it's actually got quite a story to the film as well. There's quite a lot of suspense involved, and it's kind of a thriller almost, isn't it?
It is and it isn't. It goes for 2 hours, 20 minutes. So it's fairly long, and it takes place only over about 12 months, from 1933 to Dillinger's death in 1934. There are some flashbacks, and there are some references to the past, but by and large, I didn't find it such a thriller. There are some staged events near the opening. There's a prison escape, which is engineered by Dillinger, which is done almost mesmerizingly as you watch what happens. And there are quite a number of bank robberies. He prided himself on, you know, being out in and out of the bank within 2 minutes at times.
How long did it take you to go through a bank?
About 1 minute, 40 seconds. Flat.
Well. So you see that kind of thing as well. There's also Melvin Purvis with the G-Men.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got J. Edgar Hoover, a very young J. Edgar Hoover, played by Billy Crudup wonderfully, who is trying to persuade the government to give him funds and to allow him to administer the FBI. But the men weren't quite trained, and while Melvin Purvis was very skillful, a lot of the other members of his squads weren't so skillful, so a lot of the ambushes and the planned action go wrong.
John Dillinger has given us a second chance to get John Dillinger.
But it all builds up to, I suppose, what most people who know about Dillinger know, that he went to the movies. He went to see Manhattan Melodrama with Clark Gable, William Powell and Myrna Loy. And when he came out, he was shot dead in the street in Chicago.
Of course, the film is presented as a true story.
Actually, somebody immediately said to me that during the final credits that he'd read the book on which it was based, and he said quite a number of events were actually fictionalised. So right at the end, there is a disclaimer that while it is based on actual people and events, some aspects have been fictionalised.
Okay, but it sounds like some quite good summer entertainment.
Well, it's a film for adults. It's done in a rather epic style, and it's not just matinee material.
The only way that you would leave a jail cell is when we take you out to execute you.
Well, we'll see about that.
You're listening to Vatican Radio's English program. Laudetur Jesus Christus.